World Asthma Day. It's an annual event organised by the Global Initiative for Asthma with a goal to improve asthma awareness and care around the world. It took place last week on the 2nd of May, and the World Health Organization estimates 235 million people worldwide suffer from asthma, and it's the most common chronic disease among children. The WHO also note that asthma affects people in all countries around the world, regardless of development, although most deaths occur in lower income countries, which is interesting because one of my news stories today is coming from the BBC, highlighting a very sad story. This was on the 6th of May when a 19-year-old student in Ireland died suddenly after a severe asthma attack. We'll be addressing that in a little while with my guest today. It's a real pleasure to welcome to the show Dr. Ellie Abdullah, Consultant Pulmonary and Sleep Medicine Specialist at Mediclinic Dubai Mall. Hello and welcome to the show, Dr. Ellie.
Hello, Suzanne.
Good to see you.
I'm glad to be here.
Now, you've got a very interesting title. So, Pulmonary and Sleep Medicine. Tell me what you do.
Well, basically, it's a combined specialty where I take care of people with pulmonary disease, lung diseases, and anything that pertains to sleep disorders, whether it's sleep apnea, insomnia, or a wide array of sleep diseases.
So asthma, people come to see you when?
Well, people come to see me when they have gone through a multitude of emergency department visits and many general practitioner visits. They've been having problems for months or years, and then they decide to come and see the specialist in the field. This is how they come to me, or sometimes they are referred by their primary care physicians because they're hard to be managed.
So after years of struggling with asthma, it could have an effect on the heart, is that what you're saying? Or the lungs?
The lungs, basically, yes, not the heart, absolutely.
So asthma, it's a chronic disease characterized by recurrent attacks of breathlessness and wheezing, and it can vary in severity and frequency from person to person. Is that how we define asthma? What's the medical definition of asthma?
Well, the definition of asthma is it's a chronic lung disease, and the characteristic is an airway inflammation. That's the basic pathophysiology of the disease. And this airway inflammation leads to increased airway sensitivity to a multitude of triggers. It depends on the patient's profile, but many triggers can lead to this sensitivity. But the end result is always a temporary reversible airway obstruction that leads to difficulty breathing conceived by the patient.
Well, looking at the World Health Organization, asthma deaths will increase in the next 10 years if urgent action isn't taken. Symptoms may occur several times a day or a week in affected individuals. Is that the case then? So if somebody comes to or goes to their GP first, they're feeling a bit wheezy, or maybe they've got a cold and they've got a chest infection. How do we actually diagnose that it's asthma?
Yeah, that's the most challenging part of diagnosing asthma, because a lot of patients, they go through years of being treated for quote-unquote bronchitis and recurrent infections. And they come to my office and they say, "Doc, I get infections every 2 weeks or every 2 months or every month." And the truth is they're having asthma symptoms and they have not been diagnosed with asthma. So to diagnose asthma, we have to have a clinical scenario of recurrent respiratory symptoms. These respiratory symptoms are mainly shortness of breath, that is episodic, wheezing, sometimes chest tightness, or even cough, which is a very common presenting complaint in asthmatics. Once I have a clear scenario of asthma suspicion, then we have to diagnose or go for a confirmation test for asthma. And we have at our disposal multiple tests that we can do, but the most common and the most used test is called spirometry, where patients come to the pulmonary function lab. They undergo a test whereby they blow in a machine connected to a computer, which measures how much air they can blow in and out completely of their lungs. And during the first second of of the exhalation. And then we give them a bronchodilator and we see if their airways will dilate. We look at those numbers and see if they improved by a certain percentage or not, which will make it a reactive airways. Along with the clinical scenario, then we have a diagnosis of asthma.
So who's susceptible to asthma?
That's an interesting question. It's a very hard question to answer, but asthma predisposing factors are twofold. One, genetic predisposition. Second, it's the environmental exposure. So who will develop asthma? It's very hard to tell, but if you have a sibling or a parent who has asthma, you are at a higher risk for developing asthma. If you have indoor or outdoor pollution, you are at a higher risk for developing asthma.
So interesting then. We're going to be talking later. If you're concerned about your child, we're going to be talking to Dr. Ranjan Suri from Great Ormond Street Hospital in London. He's a paediatric respiratory consultant, so looking at childhood asthma. But for the adults with you, Doctor, you can develop asthma at any time, because I know children can develop asthma and grow out of it, but you could you get asthma in your 40s?
Absolutely. And this is one surprise to patients when I tell them the patient is 45 years of age and they say, "Doctor, how can I have asthma? I'm 45 years of age." And it's a misconception, people, that asthma is only a childhood disease. It occurs most of the times during childhood, but it can happen at any age. Beyond a certain age, beyond 70 years of age, it's less likely, but I've seen people in their 40s, 50s, and 60s develop asthma for the first time.
So what might be the trigger points? I'm assuming smoking is going to possibly bring on asthma possibly, is that correct?
Well, smoking has its own risk for lung disease, and it's mostly associated with a chronic disease called COPD. But smoking is certainly a risk factor for uncontrolled asthma. The risk factors for asthma, as I told you, it's a genetic predisposition and an environmental exposure to an allergen that the patient suddenly becomes allergic to, and it leads to a completely different inflammatory cascade in the lungs, and then they develop a clinical asthma.
So to bring that into everyday terms, those allergens could be things like dust. It could be if you're in pollen, high pollen areas in the world, that could affect your breathing. It could affect you. House mites as well, is that right?
Dust
Even within
mites,
the beds,
yes.
Dust mites, yeah.
Absolutely. Grass, pollens, as you said. Respiratory infections, just to go back to your point, is one of the triggering factors in adult onset asthma. A lot of patients just get a respiratory infection, viral or bacterial, and they cannot shake off the infection or the cough or the wheezing and shortness of breath, and they come months after the infection and they see me and we do the testing, and indeed they did develop asthma after a respiratory infection, but it was not the infection itself that caused the asthma. It was like the unveiling of the disease.
The summer is upon us, and that means hot and dusty weather and an increase in people seeking treatment for what feels like a common cold, according to the national newspaper. So dusty conditions, humidity, pollution or smoke hang in the air longer on hot days. Just 15 minutes of exposure, according to this article, to smaller size sandstorm dust particles have a greater potential for asthma. We're talking about that today with Dr. Eli Abdullah, who is consultant pulmonary and sleep medicine specialist at MediClinic Dubai Mall. Thank you very much for sparing your time today and joining us. We're also going to be speaking on the line. We're going to London just in about 10 minutes time. We're going to be speaking to Dr. Ranjan Suri, who's paediatric respiratory consultant at Great Ormond Street Hospital, London, who are doing a lot of work with patients from the UAE. So, and for the grown-ups, Dr. Ellie's here on hand. Somebody here, Brian, saying, does asthma tend to return back once cured? Can it be cured?
Well, a lot of patients who have asthma can outgrow asthma, and they go into periods of remission. And after a period of remission, a respiratory infection or a big exposure to something the patient is allergic to might trigger again the inflammation and have the asthma recur in this patient. Yes, it it does tend to recur. Who's going to go in remission? Who's going to have a recurrence? It's a very tough question to answer.
And if we look at this story coming out of the UK, when I think about asthma, I have asthma, although I've not used an inhaler in many years. And in fact, the last time I had a checkup in the it was in the UK. They said you're asthma free, which was fantastic. But I was needing to use an inhaler. So I think we're aware of certain different kinds of inhalers, steroid inhalers, and for relief and for prevention of asthma attacks. But this article from the BBC, and it's sharing a sad story coming out of Ireland just this week. It's talking about a 19-year-old fit student. He was a rugby player. He died suddenly after a severe asthma attack. So his grieving father is saying, I never thought that he would die from asthma. And, you know, was it the management of his condition? So I'll give you a little bit of background. Michael Martin's son, Chris Martin, was a fit 19-year-old student who played rugby for University College Cork at the time of his sudden death. 2 days after Christmas, this was a couple of years ago, he woke up grasping for breath and died as his family tried to get medical help. His father urged those with mild asthma to manage their condition properly. In a million years, I never thought asthma would kill him. I never thought asthma would kill anyone, actually, being honest with you. The condition causes, on average, the death of one person every week in the Republic of Ireland, according to the Asthma Society of Ireland. The charity has set out to correct a popular misconception that only those with severe asthma are at risk of death.
Right, that's indeed a sad story. Yeah, Suzanne, asthma is a serious disease if we leave it untreated. And there's a different type of approach in treating asthma. We call it a stepwise approach. Not every asthmatic is going to be on the same medications as another. So patients who tend to have a mild form of the disease, we call it intermittent asthma, whereby they have once or twice per month symptoms. These patients are usually treated with only as needed bronchodilators. So if they have the symptoms, they use a rescue inhalers, as you said. The more symptoms they develop, the more severe the symptoms become, the more frequent they become, then we start stepping up in the treatment. And the gold standard treatment for asthma these days is inhaled corticosteroids. So everybody who gets more frequent symptoms will have to be on inhaled corticosteroids. In addition to that, if the symptoms are not controlled, then we can add long-acting bronchodilators. Then we can add other medications in the form of pills. And if the symptoms are still not well controlled, we try a short course of oral cortisone or oral corticosteroids. And if still we don't have a good control of the asthma, then if the patient has a known allergy and have elevated antibodies in the blood for allergens, then they might be eligible for a subcutaneous injection of a medication to fight this allergy and decrease the severity and the frequency of their asthma symptoms. But regardless of the severity of the disease, all patients with asthma need to be educated about the disease, and they have to understand that this disease can be fatal if we leave it untreated. And the best approach, and that has been clinically proven to prevent death in asthmatic patients, especially in teenagers, is to provide them with a written asthma action plan where the physician sits with the patient and they give them clear written instructions to monitor their disease activity, and they give them clear instructions on what medications to take and what to do if they don't get better. And I think this sad story that you just told me I'm not sure if the patient was on a written asthma action plan or not.
No, and I think that's a really good point, because according to a 2014 study that's raised in this article, asthma deaths in the UK found the majority of those who died had mild or moderate asthma, and that underuse of preventer inhalers was a major factor. And in this particular case of this young man, he wasn't using anything, and he woke up in the morning breathless, out of breath. The family tried to get him to hospital to get him onto a nebulizer, and he actually collapsed in front of his family and passed away. Very sad indeed.
Very sad, yes, indeed.
So management, understanding the risks and understanding that you've got the right medication in place. Having said that, not to alarm people, you can live a full and active life as an asthmatic.
Yes, indeed. If you take your medications correctly, if we prevent the exacerbations, you know how to deal with your symptoms, you will be living a fully active life. Sports, you know, going out on in the mountains and gardens, there's no limitations for an asthmatics unless there is a very well-known allergen that the patient is allergic to. This they should avoid. But other than that, they can fully live their lives without any limitations.
So just to explain what's happening to the body when one is going into what we call an asthma attack.
Right. So when a patient has an asthma attack, when they get exposed to the allergen reaches the airways and the lungs, which have been primed to respond much more violently to these allergens as compared to somebody who does not have asthma. Once that happens, then a cascade of significant inflammation happens, and a lot of toxins get released in the airways, which will lead to significant secretion of mucus and bronchospasm. These muscles that are around the airways will go into spasm, and they will block the air from coming out of the lungs. The excess secretions will block the airways as well, and patients can die from suffocation, basically. So this is the main change that happens when people have an asthma attack: an acute bronchospasm and an increased secretions of mucus.
And when going through that can be very scary indeed, the inability to breathe. And naturally, the body is going to be stressed, anxious, you're going to tense up, you might start to panic. And with that, you're going to be wanting to try and intake, you know, get sharp intakes of breath to get that oxygen into the lungs, into your body. But actually, what I learned is that that's sometimes the wrong thing to do. It's more about trying to breathe out and exhale out to calm the body. And because often that attack is about too much going too quickly into the lungs. Is that right?
That is correct. I mean, the main problem in obstructive lung disease is not taking the air in, it's taking the air out of the lungs. And when patients panic, what is the natural response of the body? It's to increase the heart rate and increase the respiratory rate. And the faster you breathe, the less likely you're going to be able to exhale the air out of your lungs. So the right thing to do is to reach out to your rescue inhaler, take two puffs, and if the symptoms are severe or you're showing any signs of cyanosis, or your lips are blue, or your fingernails are the bed is gray, then you reach out to the phone and you call for an emergency situation.
Someone here asking about inhalers, are there any side effects to taking these kind of inhalers?
Any medication you take in the world, you open the pamphlet and there's a lot of side effects you can find. But depending on the type of inhaler that you take, the side effect profile changes. For instance, if we talk about the rescue inhalers, the bronchodilators, the side effects are very minimal, but they can be troublesome to the patient because they can cause tachycardia, rapid heartbeat. They can cause tremor, and some patients experience anxiety with them. As far as inhaled corticosteroids, the side effects profile changes, and the main side effects consist of oral thrush or fungal infection in the mouth, some patients get what's called dysphonia, which is changes in the voice from those inhaled corticosteroids. But the biggest fear in patients who take inhaled corticosteroid, and I get this a lot from my patients, is that, doc, I don't want to be on steroids because of, you know, diabetes, osteoporosis, it decreases my immunity and so forth and so on. The truth is, yes, a small amount of this inhaled corticosteroids, they do go into the systemic circulation, but the clinical effect is very low unless the patient is on extremely high doses of inhaled corticosteroids. For the other inhalers like long-acting beta agonists, they don't really have a significant amount of side effects, but patients should know that those medications should not be used as a monotherapy, as the sole therapy in asthma, because they have a black box warning on them. They should always be used with inhaled corticosteroids in asthmatics.
We're marking World Asthma Day, which was on the 2nd of May, and we'll return to our conversation with Dr. Ellie on adult asthma when we come back, and also speaking on the line to London, to Great Ormond Street, to Dr. Ranjan Suri. He can help us when it comes to childhood asthma. He's doing a lot of work with patients here in the UAE. So if you've got any questions for Dr. Ranjan, send those through as well. Marking World Asthma Day, which was on the 2nd of May, and talking in conversation, do send your questions through to Dr. Ellie Abdullah, who's Consultant Pulmonary and Sleep Medicine Specialist at Mediclinic Dubai Mall. And we're going to be talking now about childhood asthma, and apparently it's on the rise. And we're going to London, to Great Ormond Street, to welcome to the show Dr. Ranjan Suri. Hello and welcome, sir.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me, and good afternoon to yourself and all your listeners.
Thank you so much. We're looking here at this article, 2009 survey conducted in Al Ain here in the UAE, assessed the impact of asthma on school attendance and found that 62% of asthmatic boys and 72% of asthmatic girls missed at least one day of school due to asthma. That was back in 2009. We're in 2017. How do you view childhood asthma, doctor? Is it getting better or is it getting worse?
I think childhood asthma is increasingly recognised now. Parents are more aware of the symptoms, doctors are more aware of the diagnosis, but we are seeing increasing levels of asthma throughout the world. So that level, if it was repeated, they would probably have increased, yes. So increasing numbers of both boys and girls with asthma.
So childhood asthma, the difference, we know that asthma is about a response to an allergen, and so things like dust or pollen, temperature change, that kind of thing. But we also understand that you can grow out of childhood asthma, is that right?
That's absolutely right. So in childhood asthma, similar to adult asthma, is caused by the small breathing tubes or airways or bronchi becoming red, swollen and sensitive. And once again, this is triggered by things like catching a cold, exercise, cigarette smoke, dust mite, pets and pollen. So those are the common triggers that lead on to childhood asthma. And you're absolutely right, a lot of children do grow out of asthma. Many children who are younger, i.e. the preschool age group, often do grow out of it by the time they reach school age. And even older children do grow out of it. And to be honest with you, no one really knows why a child grows out of asthma, but we do see that increasingly, that children do grow out of asthma. So even if someone's made a diagnosis and a child has been diagnosed with asthma, it's not necessarily a lifelong condition. Children do grow out of it.
We were talking earlier about a very sad case of a 19-year-old boy in Ireland who tragically died of an asthma attack. Fatalities in children, is that something on the rise?
Unfortunately, we are still seeing fatalities with asthma in children. In terms of it's on the rise, no, I think it's remained pretty much the same. But unfortunately, we are still seeing children with asthma, having asthma being a fatal condition in some children, either those children whose asthma is very severe, so very poorly controlled, or in some children, unfortunately, who aren't appropriately managed during an acute exacerbation, or who aren't taking their inhalers regularly and develop a nasty viral illness, and that can sometimes spiral out of control if not appropriately managed. So, you know, we still do need to take asthma seriously. By far, the majority of children with asthma are very well controlled, have minimal symptoms if they're taking their inhalers or medication regularly, but we do see some children who unfortunately, it can lead to significant morbidity and mortality, unfortunately.
Now, our text messages are alive with people texting in with questions for you, Dr. Ranjan, so I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit. I hope you don't mind, but let me share a couple of these with you. My son is 4 years of age and he has asthma and he's allergic to dust and perfumes. He's been using Fixatide Evo inhaler since for the last 2 months, one puff twice a day. Is this safe for him?
So it sounds like obviously we're dealing with a four-year-old who's got asthma with various allergies and sensitivities. So the child at the moment on Fixatide, which is an inhaled steroid. So in terms of asthma medication, there's two types of medications. One's a preventer, which hopefully stops the attacks from happening, and that's usually in the form of an inhaled steroid or sometimes even granules. And the other one's a reliever, something called Ventolin, which children use at the time of an attack. So Fixatide's a preventer. So this child's doctor has deemed that the child's asthma is significant enough for the child to be on a preventer, hence the Fixatide. So Fixatide is safe. Okay. It really depends on what dose the child is receiving and whether the dose is significant enough or corresponds to the level of symptoms that the child has. Because what you want to do in terms of asthma management is to make sure the child's symptoms are being controlled by the dose. So you just need to get that balance right between the dose of the inhaled steroid versus the level of symptoms. So whenever I start a child on an inhaled steroid, such as a Fixatide, it's really important that they're reviewed every 2 to 3 months to assess their level of symptoms. Now, clearly, if the symptoms have improved, then the next step at that 2 or 3 month consultation would be to try to wean down the dose of Fixatide. And that's really the key. The important thing is once you do start a child on an inhaled steroid or a regular medication for asthma, the child must be reviewed every 2 to 3 months, because hopefully once the asthma is under control, you can wean down the dose.
And here someone's asking, is there such a thing as viral asthma? When my four-year-old has a cold, she frequently gets asthma-type attacks in the night. She can't get her breath and struggles to breathe. It's terrifying, and we aren't sure how to help her. It never happens when she's it's only when she's got a cold it happens.
So there is a condition called viral-induced wheeze. Probably about 10 years ago, we'd lump everything together. Those children who just wheeze with viruses with those who have what we call genuine asthma. So the difference is a child with viral-induced wheeze will just wheeze or cough during a viral upper respiratory tract infection. And in between, when the child doesn't have a viral upper respiratory tract infection, the child is absolutely fine. So they've got no what we call interval symptoms. So they're active, running around, no coughing, no difficulty in breathing when they don't have a viral upper respiratory tract infection. The difference between that and asthma is children with asthma tend to have symptoms even in between viral upper respiratory tract infections. So if a child doesn't have a cold, will still be symptomatic, usually caused by other triggers such as cold air, sometimes the air conditioning, dust, pollen, etc. So moving back to this case, so there is a condition, absolutely right, called what we call viral-induced wheeze or viral-induced asthma. So the child just becomes wheezy or difficulty in breathing when they have an upper respiratory tract infection. So for those children, the management is slightly different. So we would use a reliever such as salbutamol, and there are some preventers you can use. There's one called Montelukast, which is a granule, which we sometimes use in condition with viral-induced wheeze, and we just give it at the time of the viral illness. So there are alternatives to inhaled steroids for children with viral-induced wheeze, but you know, and just like with asthma, children with viral-induced wheeze or viral-induced asthma, it must be taken seriously.
A few people have texted in with various symptoms, and they're all basically what it comes down to is wheezing. And so any, you know, we don't want to be alarmist about this at all, but when should somebody go and maybe to their GP for the first, you know, consultation just to get their child checked out? What kind of symptoms would you say, you know what, just go and get checked out?
Okay, so I would say probably the main symptoms for asthma would be a child who's coughing, wheezing, difficulty in breathing, or complaining of chest tightness. And if these symptoms are ongoing and there's no improvement, then I would recommend the child be seen by a doctor. So it's more a case of if the symptoms are ongoing. We do know with a viral upper respiratory tract infection, the child is going to have a bit of a cough, but it's more a case of if the cough is persistent or the child's complaining of difficulty in breathing or chest tightness. Those would be the symptoms I'd be concerned about. It is difficult for a parent to diagnose wheezing. It's often better diagnosed with a doctor with a stethoscope. But if a child does have noisy breathing or difficulty in breathing, those would be the symptoms I'd be concerned about.
And some parents, you know, feel, and you can understand this, my child's got asthma. I don't want them to do exercise in school or take part in sports. What do you advise? What do you say to that?
Okay. I mean, once we've made the diagnosis of asthma, part of the management is to allow the child to lead as normal a life as possible, i.e. the ability for the child to take part in sport, take part in games, swimming, do everything else any other child would do. And the whole point of the management is to start the child on medication so that the child is able to do those activities. And so at the moment, in terms of asthma management, what we always recommend is there should be no restriction, and we should manage the child so they're able to do all those activities. So rather than having the child restricted, i.e., you know, not able to do physical education or games, etc., if anything, our management tends to be the opposite. We would encourage them to do all those things, but we need to make sure, as doctors from our management, that the child is being managed adequately so they're able to do those activities without developing symptoms. And if they are developing symptoms, obviously we need to change our management.
Now, Dr. Ranjan, you and your team work with patients in the Middle East, and many, many of them each and every single year. What would you advise for parents listening to this to create an asthma-safe home? Any tips for the home?
Okay. So in terms of an asthma-safe home, there are certain tips that we can put in place. I would say, number one, it's very useful to keep the rooms well-aired, especially if they have new furniture. It's important to try to clean thoroughly to control the dust as much as you can. I would suggest avoiding spray cleaners and use solids or liquids instead, and avoid scented products as much as you can, because we do know perfumes and scented products can exacerbate asthma. It's often quite useful to use an air filter or purifier. That sometimes does help in some children. But the key really is to make sure the house is well ventilated. So those are sort of some of the common things that I would suggest can be put in place to try to create an asthma-safe home.
And we'll bring Dr. Ellie in here. Dr. Ellie, your thoughts on this?
Well, this is absolutely correct. That's right. Everything that doctor just said. In addition to that, I would like to say that in the UAE, we have air conditioning systems that are working 24/7, and we get sandstorms. And these AC ducts, they need to also be cleaned on a yearly basis, because they can be a source of a lot of dust and mold if not cleaned regularly.
The mold is really key as well. It's something to be really aware of. Dr. Ranjan, before I let you go, there at Great Ormond
Sure.
Street in London, very familiar with that road where you're based, and of course with great history with Great Ormond Street Hospital, helping children, sick children, and of course you're helping children here in the Middle East as well. We've shared this morning the fact that asthma is on the rise, and just to give your thoughts when it comes to general pollutants. You know, we talk on the show on all manner of things each and every week about the environment and how that's impacting us. What do you think about that, other than the allergens we've talked about when it comes to dust, when it comes to you know, dust mites and pollen? Do you think the rest of our environment is impacting our health when it comes to childhood asthma?
Yeah, that's a very, very good point. I think there's no doubt that pollutants in the environment, be it from factories, be it from car exhaust fumes, diesel fumes, they are definitely causing a problem, exacerbating asthma. So that's a big problem, not only in the Middle East, I'm sure, but even in London. We have similar sort of problems in terms of trying to control car exhaust fumes, and particularly the level of pollutants. More and more research is coming out showing that higher levels of pollutants do exacerbate respiratory conditions such as asthma. So it is an increasing problem. I think it's a problem worldwide, unfortunately, that we do need to tackle, but it is a significant issue.
Dr. Ranjan Suri, paediatric respiratory consultant at Great Ormond Street Hospital, London, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you very much for inviting me. Thank you
so much. Doing great work there and doing great work here as well. According to a local study, it reports that a percentage of asthmatic UAE patients have had emergency room visits within a year, 27.5%, and a further 4% of asthmatic patients were hospitalised. We've been hearing throughout the hour, asthma is on the rise here and across the globe for many reasons, but it is an allergen. It's your physical response to an allergen, whether it be dust, whether it be pollen, whether it be temperature change. Maybe you've developed a respiratory infection that could lead to asthma. So restriction of the airwaves, difficulty to breathe, wheezing, coughing, that kind of thing could be all symptoms of asthma. And we're talking to Dr. Ellie Abdullah, consultant pulmonary and sleep medicine specialist at Mediclinic Dubai Mall. Just to come back on a few more things to be aware of indoors, those indoor pollutants that could affect us.
Two more things I would like to add to indoors pollution that patients have a really hard time dealing with. For instance, pets at home. If the patient is allergic to cats or dogs and they have a cat or dog, it's very hard to give it up. And one advice I give my patients all the time is that it's okay if you keep the pet at home, but keep that pet outside of your bedroom. This is where you spend most of the time in contact with the sheets and the pillows and all that, and don't allow them to be in the bedroom. Also, plants play a major role indoors, and I try to advise my patients to get rid of indoor plants. And last but not least, if somebody in the house smokes, it's very highly advisable to tell them to go outside and smoke instead of having the smoke indoors, because this is a major source of uncontrolled asthma as an indoor pollution.
Now, what about the things we always talk about, diet, nutrition, exercise? Can it make a difference to whether you develop asthma or managing asthma?
So far, I don't think there has been a connection between a certain type of diet and asthma. There are some research there ongoing, but the data is not really conclusive. Exercise definitely improves the health, the overall health of patients, but it does not cause asthma. There's a subset of patients who have what's called exercise-induced asthma, and this type of asthma is treated differently from the rest of the patients, as long as the symptoms are limited to when they exercise. And instead of putting them on a maintenance medication, controller medication that they have to take morning and evening, whether they do or do not have symptoms, we ask them to do a bronchodilator, a Ventolin, half an hour before they do the exercise. And that, in most instances, controls their disease.
So if you are struggling with medication, so you've been put on various medications, but you're still getting symptoms of asthma, what are the options? Are there more and more choices when it comes to treatments?
That is a very interesting question, because a lot of patients have been to my office and they're on maximal amount of asthma medications you can imagine. And I sit down with them and I have them bring their medications to my office and I tell them to demonstrate to me how are they using their medications. And you'd be surprised looking at how some patients use their medications. So the technique that they use, if you go to the pharmacy and you look at the various devices that we have available for inhalers, it's mind-blowing. And for somebody who's not a medical professional, if you don't sit down with them and explain to them how to open that inhaler and demonstrate the appropriate technique, you can give them all the medications in the world and they will not improve, because the medications is not reaching their airways where it's supposed to be working. Mm. So this is my number one thing to do when a patient comes to me and he or she tells me, "Doc, I'm not improving with these medications." The second thing that I eliminate or go through when a patient is not controlled, instead of adding a medication, I go through their environmental control. Do you still smoke? Surprisingly, asthmatics 22% of them continue to smoke. It's even higher prevalence than the rest of the healthy population. So smoke is very important. The number three condition to go through in an uncontrolled asthmatic before we add more medications is to control comorbidities or conditions that might worsen their asthma. In other words, acid reflux, for instance, is a major contributor to uncontrolled asthma. And if left untreated, you will never achieve good asthma control.
That's interesting. So the acid reflux comes first.
That's correct. Yeah, it can cause inflammation in the esophagus or the food pipe, which spills over to the airways and then triggers a cascade of inflammation leading to airflow obstruction. Another very common condition associated with asthma, and if left untreated, can cause uncontrolled asthma, is allergic rhinitis. Patients who do have allergic rhinitis or allergy of the nose and the sinuses, they do have uncontrolled asthma until you control their allergic rhinitis.
You mentioned that people's inability to use their inhalers, their medication properly for it to be effective. But similarly, and we've talked about this before, maybe it's a conversation we can have with you again, being a sleep specialist too, is that we don't breathe properly, just generally, whether we have asthma or not, we're not really using our breathing apparatus as well as we should.
Can you rephrase the question?
Well, do you think we're breathing properly? Do you think we know how to breathe properly, just generally speaking?
Well, generally speaking, I think we don't think about breathing unless you're doing meditation. I think that this is an automated breathing technique. Now, with a lot of anxiety and the busy city life, I think sometimes we get in the habit of doing bad things. But in general, I don't see this pattern or this as a medical problem, at least as of now. This might change in the future, but I don't think, you know, we think about breathing.
Well, I think this is a conversation we can continue with at another time, because I would say that most of us are breathing just from the top part of our chest and not breathing deep and using the full apparatus. And if we're able to do that, then and build our lung capacity and strength, we might be better equipped. This is me as a layman just saying this, my own personal thoughts and research into
very
it.
Very interesting.
I'll bring you back for that conversation, Doctor. Thank you very much for your time today as well. Dr. Elie Abdullah, Consultant Pulmonary and Sleep Medicine Specialist at Mediclinic Dubai Mall. Thank you very
much.
My
pleasure.
Thank you. And thanks to everyone for listening and for all your messages today. It's been quite an enlightening show. And of course, it will be podcast later. So within the next hour, you can tune in if you wish to our website, DubaiEye1038.com/DubaiToday. All of my podcasts are there.